Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
Happy December, you guys.
Happy December. How was your Thanksgiving? Was it everything that you imagined and more? Was it good? Did you eat all the yummy foods?
Did you take yummy naps after? Did you watch the Bob's Burgers Thanksgiving episodes marathons?
No.
Nothing is more comforting and more stressful to me than watching those. Because every time I'm like, he just wants to have a good day.
Haven't been there myself.
But Linda makes up for it every time. I'm like, he has a good day. He's married to her. Okay.
I feel like, what do we normally, you and I watched Planes, Trains, and Automobiles? Do we normally do that around the holidays? That's like our...
It's gotta be.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
I love it. I had such a thing for movies like that for such a long time. Listen, I'm a yapper. Okay, sometimes things come out of my mouth before I have the time to critically think about them. So the first time I saw it, someone was like, oh, you want to watch this? And I was like, yeah, what's it about? And they were like, planes, trains, and automobiles. And then they were like, do you want to see snakes on a plane? And I was like, yeah, what's it about? And they were like, oh, God, snakes on a plane.
I love a good, like, older John Candy movie.
Yes.
Steve Martin. Come on. If you guys have not watched Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yada.
We are a couple of old souls here and we would highly recommend it.
Any Steve Martin, I'm in.
My dad and I always quote the part, the gobble gobble.
Yes, you do.
Aw, Janice, you're a stitch.
Yes. And then my family also always does like, we'll go out to a movie around Thanksgiving.
Aww.
Some people do it like on Thanksgiving. I don't think we've ever had like a specific date, but have y'all seen Wicked?
No.
I am looking forward to seeing it, I think. I've heard really mixed reviews in the same review from everybody where they're like, I really loved certain parts and I really didn't love other parts.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious to see what that looks like.
I'm not a musical kind of gal, so I feel like I'll sit this one out.
Fair.
I appreciate it.
I've had a Wicked love for a long time, but I'm not sure how I'm feeling. I'm excited.
We'll take it.
I'm excited, and I wish it was one movie because I don't think it needed to be two. But
so it is two, right?
Yeah, they're doing like two parts, which if the musical can do it in one,
Movies. Come on, girl.
Well, if it isn't the capitalism of our society, but you know what? I don't know. I'm excited. It should be good. I'm curious to see what y'all think. I'll let you know my thoughts when I see it. But super exciting. We hope you guys had such a good holiday and that your weird uncle wasn't like too much. Oh my God, I did see a bunch of reels though that like I am on like the therapy teacher side of Instagram, TikTok algorithms. And one of my favorite people who posts does like talking to your family like they're your kindergartens. And it's like, uh-oh, I think you said an inside thought out loud. Can we hold that in, buddy? Like, is this a big problem or a little problem?
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Does it hurt your body and heart? No? Okay. Little problem.
Oh, no.
So we hope that wasn't a lot for you guys and that you've had a delightful amount of time to take post-turkey naps and to recover before the next big ones that are coming up here.
And now that we're officially in December, I'm pretty confident that Mariah Carey and Michael Bublé have fully defrosted. Oh my God. All right. Well, we have a lot to get into today.
Yes.
So.
And if y'all can't tell, my brain is functioning at like 60% anyway. So we're probably going to need, to get into it like soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Let's do that.
Like now?
Yeah. I think you have a thing to say.
Ooh. Yoo-hoo! Pod's on. Can y'all lock in, please?
Yeah. Buckle up.
Keep your hands, arms, feet, legs,
tushies. Inside the podcast at all times.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Click your ticket, bitch.
A bumpy ride. So hi, hello, and welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast. Aww. About Time for True Crime.
You didn't have to do that.
We are so blessed that we get to hang out with you every week in our little corner of the true crime world. Your support means everything to us. And if you'd like to help support the pod, we hope you'll consider rating 5 stars, sharing on social media, telling a friend, all that good, good.
Yes. And you can do all that down below, babe.
Our community would not be what it is today without you. So thank you.
Thingy.
If you are new here,
hi.
Abby and I are just a couple of 20-something best friends working in the criminal justice field. We have a combined decade of education in criminal justice, also in psychology.
Oh, yeah.
And we have a combined even longer working in the field. But we do not represent our workplaces. We do this purely because we are weirdo nerds like you and entirely in our free time because we think that these cases are important to share. And we think that we can bring a unique perspective with the lens we look at each case through.
Yeah. Hi.
We believe that if you are not laughing, you are indeed crying. And if you work in the field or know someone who does, you might know that gallows humor is how most of us cope. You'll see that here. Please know that our use of humor is just that, a coping mechanism, and how we try to bring a little bit of levity to crushingly heavy topics. We mean no disrespect at the expense of the victims, but also full offense at the expense of the attackers.
Often, yeah.
So if you're new, we welcome you with open arms and cute little nose boop.
Aww.
And on behalf of us both, I'm sorry that this is your introduction, because this probably ranks top 5 of the hardest cases I have covered.
Ugh. All right, we're hopping right back in.
Yes.
Full steam ahead.
The murders we're covering are seldom spoken of. Not because of irrelevance or a cover-up, not because of politics or a community's pride, but because the details of the crime are so chilling, so gruesome, that the material was determined to be too brutal for daytime television.
Holy shit.
And in the 80s and 90s, this was largely the only way to get word out about unsolved cases. So with that sort of stream being cut off, it just didn't get the coverage that it should have.
Ugh.
So with this, I am issuing a big, fat, glowing, bolded and underlined neon sign trigger warning for this episode to include violence, murder, child sexual abuse, ooh, sexual violence, mutilation, and unfortunately, very little closure. Listen with care, take care of yourselves. We are going to dive into it.
All right. I am getting buckled up. For those of you who don't know, when we do these, the other person never knows what it's about unless it's like a long-standing series. So if you are recently joining, our Teal Swan was not our typical. This is significantly more average for us, where one of us comes with a throat sucker punch, gut punch, awful, terrible, horrible thing. And the other person just gets to experience it live with you.
Yes.
Right now. So hi, that's me. I have tissues.
Abby has no idea what we're going to be talking about. And she does not have the luxury that you all have to like pause it.
Nope.
She is stuck right here with me. So as you may have guessed from the title, you clicked it, not me. We're covering the Dardeen family murders.
What is it with you and the family massacres, dude?
This one, I will talk about it. I didn't want to cover it, and then I figured I had to.
Yeah.
So we're going to jump ahead to the day in question, and I promise we're going to go back and fill in the earlier details in a bit. But I just want you to have an idea of where we're headed, and then you can proceed with caution from there.
Awesome.
November 18th, 1987, law enforcement arrived at the home of Keith and Elaine Dardeen for a welfare check.
Okay.
Keith hadn't shown for work, which had never happened before. His supervisor had called his parents to see if they'd heard from him. Hmm. They tried to call him. They couldn't reach him. And at that point, they shared that same concern that the work had, and then they requested the welfare check. They were like, this isn't like him. He wouldn't do this. So
I appreciate a fast-acting family.
Yes. Keith's dad was already at the family's trailer when law enforcement arrived because he had a key and he could get them access. So he went to meet law enforcement for this welfare check.
Cool.
Upon entering, first responders saw a scene out of your worst nightmare.
Mm.
A scene that would haunt them for life. Inside, the body of 3 family members were found. All had been beaten to death.
Oh my God.
So let's back it up. Both Dardines went by their middle names. Elaine was born Ruby Elaine Cowling in 1957. In 1977, when she was 20, she married 19-year-old Russell Keith Dardine, who went by Keith. So Keith and Elaine.
Okay.
Elaine and Keith were honest, hardworking people who loved each other and loved their family. The couple were Illinois locals and chose to raise their family there, too. In 1984, just a few years into their marriage, the couple welcomed their first child, a son that they named Peter Sean Dardine.
Okay.
Keith worked as a plant operator at a facility for the Wren Lake Water Conservancy District, and shortly after completing additional training, he purchased a trailer in Ina, Illinois in 1986.
Okay.
My guess is this additional training earned him a pay increase, and then he felt more comfortable to make this purchase.
Fair.
Because it seemed kind of emphasized that he waited until this was done for him to make this purchase and kind of buy the family's home. Ina was west of where Keith and Elaine grew up. The trailer was on land that they rented from a farming couple, and their landlady remembered them as very likable and friendly.
Mm.
Elaine had found work working as a secretary for an office supply company, and the two lived an otherwise happy, healthy life. In their free time, they went to a Baptist church where they were both involved in music. Elaine played the piano and Keith sang in the choir. Apparently, he was like a lead vocalist. Very, very beautiful singing well-rounded voice for him.
Love that.
They wouldn't be a family of three for too long, though, because in 1987, Elaine learned she was pregnant with their second.
Oh.
They even had names picked out. Casey, if it were a girl, and Ian, if it was a boy.
Oh, I love that.
No family is perfect, but this one seemed pretty damn close. Little Peter, a toddler, called his mother Wayne because it was the closest he could pronounce to Elaine.
Oh.
But he knew that that's what his mom's name was, so he tried, and it was just Wayne. And friends and family knew that this sweet boy called his mom Wayne, which is why it was especially cute when, on Elaine's 30th birthday, Keith brought Peter to her work, and he carried a little sign that said, "My mommy is 30 today. Happy birthday, Wayne." Is that not the cutest thing?
I love that. Happy birthday, Wayne.
In a book I used for this episode, the author Diane Fanning wrote about a Halloween costume competition that the family participated in.
Aww.
We'll talk a little bit about the book in a bit, but I think the name would throw us off, so I'm going to hold off.
Okay.
But in this book, she wrote that in 1996 that this costume thing happened, which actually does not make sense. That would have been impossible. So I think it was a typo meant for 1986.
Got it.
Elaine had made costumes for their little family, and it was a little Wizard of Oz theme. So Keith was the Tin Man, she was the Scarecrow, and Peter was the Cowardly Lion.
I love that.
And for her hard work on the costumes, because she made them all, Eileen won the family the best costume ribbon that year.
Aww.
For Peter's third birthday, Keith got him a baseball bat. It was far too big for him. He was three, but he knew that Peter would grow into it, and he looked forward to playing baseball with his son.
Right.
In preparation for the new baby, the Dardines carefully considered their current situation. Because Ina, Illinois had, at that time, a few years of seemingly soaring violent crime.
Okay.
What had been a close-knit, quintessential small town seemed to have been plagued with a violent streak that no one saw coming.
Hmm.
And it had the community on edge. Everybody felt this. Of the many headlines and murders that took place in this area at that time, most notable were the crimes committed by 19-year-old Thomas Odell.
Okay.
Thomas had systematically murdered each of his family members as they got home. After coming back from either work or school, he murdered both of his parents.
Holy crap.
And three siblings.
Oh my. Whole family.
The whole family. The community did not see this coming and obviously were shocked. And that same familiar outcry that our avid true crime listeners know poured out. This doesn't happen in our neighborhood. Everyone knows everyone. It must have been someone else. How did this happen? Because especially if we really do feel safe where we are, we of course think that the killer can't be from around here.
Right.
And Thomas Odell's case was one glaring, red hot contradiction of that.
This happens here.
One that challenged the community's feeling of safety and security that we all want in our neighborhoods.
Right.
So this was just one of the cases that the Dardines knew of that was local to them. And as they're preparing to welcome another baby, they're thinking, do we want this here? Because they had moved out to Ina. They didn't grow up here.
Right.
So they were kind of considering moving back to where they were both from, where they felt the most comfortable.
Well, and I can imagine, too, that, you know, as someone who doesn't have kids, part of my thought when I think about a family or I think about the future is what kind of world I'd be bringing my children into. And so I can imagine if you already have one and you have another one on the way, that is a significantly bigger, glaring debate question that you have. And so to then find out that there's like family violence happening, you're going to want to get out of there.
Well, and that's just it, is because this crime aside, there were something like 10 or 15 other homicides in that area in the last few years.
That's a lot.
Which was a lot. And definitely considering per capita how small this was like the crime rate was pretty significant. And Keith and Elaine wanted to move back east where they were both familiar.
Right.
In fact, Joanne, Keith's mom, said that Keith was going to move back to Mount Carmel, where he was from originally, even if he didn't have a job there yet.
Wow.
So he was like, we'll move and I'll figure it out when we get there.
But we're going.
Because he thought it was just getting too violent where they were.
Yeah.
He wanted what was best for his wife and son, their new baby on the way. They'd started making those arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he was so on edge that a woman had come to their front door and like knocked and asked to use their phone because her car had broken down up the road and he didn't let her in.
Wow.
Because he wasn't willing to put his family in danger. When previously he'd surely have helped this woman, he wasn't going to let somebody he didn't know into his house because he had very precious cargo. He had his wife and his kids there. I mean, what is more important? And he just didn't feel like it was safe enough to do that anymore, which was pretty sad because this community was like, we don't lock our doors. Of course, you can use my phone.
Right.
Just years before this, you know? He actually put the trailer up for sale in 1987.
Okay.
So they'd only been there a short while before they realized they didn't want to be there anymore.
Right.
And so they had a for sale sign out front.
Okay.
In November 1987, Elaine was 7 months pregnant. She was due early January.
Aww.
On the 18th, Keith never showed to work, which, again, had never happened before. After his supervisor tried to call him at home and couldn't reach him, he called Keith's mother, Joanne Dardine. Joanne called her ex-husband, Keith's dad. His name is Don. That evening, after not hearing from Keith, they requested that welfare check.
Good.
So they lived, Joanne and Don lived like not far from each other. They were on like fine terms. They were divorced.
Yeah.
So I think Keith's boss had called Joanne, and Joanne was like, well, let me check with his dad. And then when time had gone by and neither of them could reach him, they were like, this doesn't feel right. So
good.
That's when they moved forward with that.
And I'll say that's even more impressive for a fast response time to be coordinating multiple people in multiple locations and still get in same day.
Exactly. But this is when that gruesome discovery was made.
Ugh.
And it's going to get rough here for a bit, so skip ahead if you don't want details. But inside, they saw a bloody, horrific scene. One of senseless, brutal, unimaginable evil. I can't describe it differently. The bodies were on the couple's bed, all tucked in together.
Oh.
There were three of them. But likely not the three that you'd expect. Because Keith was not there.
Oh. Oh my gosh.
30-year-old Elaine had been beaten to death. Her skull had several fractures. Due to the intensity of this beating, Elaine went into labor and she delivered her baby, a girl that they were going to name Casey.
Oh my.
The killer also killed baby Casey. 3-year-old Peter was also beaten to death, and his mother and just as his mother and sister had been. The bodies were moved in a line on the bed, which was odd, like they were kind of tucked in. And aside from the initial shock at this nightmare scene, there were also so many questions. Of course, who did this? How did this happen? Why were they killed? And why so ferociously? But the first question that they really needed answered was what they'd hoped would help answer the rest. And that was, where was Keith?
Right.
Because when the family heard three bodies, well, that meant everybody.
Right.
But it wasn't. After searching the home, they couldn't find him. And he was understandably their prime suspect.
Yeah.
His vehicle was missing from the driveway, so they figured that he was on the run. Keith's parents were divorced again, and police looked for him in both of the parents' homes, thinking maybe he went there to hide. Maybe his parents were concealing him.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You'd never imagine that your son would do this, and I'd hope that you wouldn't conceal him, but that's still your child, too.
Right.
After searching both of their homes, though, he wasn't there. When Joanne Dardeen, Keith's mom, was told about the scene, she was, of course, horrified, but also really confused. Because she's like, what do you mean there's three bodies and Keith wasn't one of them? Who's the third? And they said, a newborn. And Joanne said, okay, but they didn't have a newborn. She was pregnant, but she wasn't due until January.
Right.
And that is how Joanne found out about her only granddaughter. The fact that her granddaughter was born in the midst of torture and that she was also killed. Suspicion was placed firmly on 29-year-old Keith, but not for long. The next day, his body was found by hunters in a wheat field not far from his home.
Mm-hmm.
He had been shot 3 times in the head and his penis had been severed from his body.
Oh my God.
His vehicle was found parked near the local police station, which law enforcement took as a taunt from the killer. Like, look how close I was and you didn't know it.
Right.
There are several words that come to mind. Many I won't say out loud here, but to name a few, savage, barbaric, cold-blooded, and evil seem to describe this. This was an unthinkable crime, one whose brutality is so off the charts. If you saw it in a movie, you'd turn it off and say, even for art, that's too much. And this wasn't art, this was real. A mother was beaten into labor, and her minutes-old newborn met the same fate. A 3-year-old boy was beaten to death in front of his mother, who was helpless to save him. What they must have felt, what they must have thought, what they must have prayed for in those moments, I cannot fathom it. The investigation kicked off, though.
Mm-hmm.
The autopsies revealed that the family had mostly all died within an hour or so of each other.
Oh my gosh.
Elaine had been bound and gagged. She had been beaten with a baseball bat. The same baseball bat that Keith had gotten Peter just months earlier for his birthday.
I was worried you were going to say that.
The deadly blow seemed to be a blow to the top right side of her skull, which fractured it. Peter was also beaten with the bat, his own birthday present. And some sources say Peter was also bound and gagged, but I didn't see that everywhere.
Hmm.
And I do kind of question the need to tie up a toddler. I mean, he's 3. I don't know what...
Right.
Unless you're just afraid of him running away, I don't know that he could have done anything to prevent this. His skull was also fractured and he had several contusions and abrasions to his body.
Wow.
Blood spatter was found in Keith's car, which led them to believe that he was mutilated in it before he was brought to the wheat field. So it's possible that that was where his genitals were severed, or at the very least, he may have been shot.
Right.
In the car. Because he had been shot in the forehead and on both sides of his face.
Well, and that's the only variation that we see, right? Because the other three were beaten.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the only one with a firearm.
He's the only one with the firearm. He's
injured.
Sexually mutilated.
Yeah.
And he's away from the others.
Which is a very curious... There, I feel like there's a few ways that you can go with that, but they're all very specific
mm-hmm.
towards Keith.
Well, and based on the evidence, investigators theorized that Keith was taken away from the home by the killer.
Yeah.
And then he was mutilated and shot in the vehicle before being brought into the field and then shot 2 more times.
Okay.
Then the killer went back to the trailer and killed Peter and Elaine.
Interesting. Okay.
And then during Elaine's attack, she delivered the baby.
Right.
At that time. So they think the order of events was like, Keith was brought away from the home, killed, the killer went back, and then killed everybody in the house.
Yeah.
But the timing of that would have been pretty close.
Right, and it has to be tight if they're all killed within about an hour of each other, which means there's not a lot of like the killer isn't going out there and really enjoying this process. He's not taking his time, or she, you know, whoever it ends up
right.
being.
But it like, didn't. It didn't seem like that with Keith. It seemed pretty
right,
pretty instant,
in and out. And then also, if everybody died within an hour, to then drive back and mm-hmm. take care of everybody else, it's a lot of rage sustained for an hour.
Oh yeah, this case was a mystery from the start, though. No suspects, no motives.
Yeah, they seemed great. Everything you said sounds like developing new family. You know, again, nobody's perfect, but you often don't have enough time within a year to make a really bad name for yourself or that many enemies, especially when that's what you're known for, is like a developing family. Your whole life is normally going into that.
They're new to the area.
Right.
They're adorable. Their son is the cutest little thing. They're involved in their church.
They work hard.
They made friends. They both work. They work hard. They weren't involved in anything nefarious. Like, we're going to talk about it, but it's... Even, like, from the outside looking in, you wouldn't think anyone would have anything against them. And then even once you're inside looking out, you still don't think that.
Right. And you said this is Illinois, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's not Georgia, so it wasn't the devil, you know? Like...
right.
That's not to say Georgia House is the devil. That's just a joke about the song. But like, there's literally, like, I'm grasping at straws. There's nothing.
Well, and here's the thing, because it seemed that the killer or killers.
Yeah.
You know, it
fair.
Seems pretty.
You gotta ask.
Seems possible that it could be two to do that kind of damage. But that seems like they were let in the home because there were no signs of forced entry. The back door had been unlocked, no windows broken, nothing like that. But weirder was that cash, jewelry, and a VCR and camera were in plain sight. They weren't taken.
No robbery. Yeah.
The murder weapon was the baseball bat that was found in the home. The killer didn't bring it with him.
Right.
Neither of them were having an affair. That was confirmed. Neither had debt. Neither were involved in illegal or high-risk activity. They were pretty straight edge and friendly, without enemies, loved by their community. There was no one that would want to hurt them. And the obvious motives, theft, sex, drugs, they all fell short. They thought, well, maybe Keith owed money to a loan shark. Maybe it wasn't debt that would have been on the books.
Right.
But everyone who knew him said, no, absolutely not. In fact, the man turned in cans for change to go into his kid's college fund. Aww. Like, he was as frugal as they come.
Yeah.
And he didn't gamble. He didn't get involved in anything like that. And he certainly wouldn't have owed money to somebody else.
Right. And if I'm being honest, the out of everything I know, the only thing that would make sense in my head at this point is really good people see something they shouldn't. And the people who did the wrong thing know they're really good people and would do something about it. And that's all I have. But that doesn't feel like enough anger or rage for the brutality of four deaths within an hour. That's like an average of 15 minutes a person, and this is a brutal beating for three of the four of them, and one of them was transported.
Yeah,
that's a lot to do.
That's a busy hour.
And I would assume it would take a shitload of rage that I simply wouldn't have for trying to clean up loose ends if I did something else wrong. So that's the only thing I have, and that doesn't even make sense.
No, like, exactly. And throughout all of this, like, theories emerge and then they kind of get like stomped out.
Right.
But one included drug dealing, because at the scene, they found a very small amount of marijuana, which at the time was, whoa, that's bad, you know?
Yeah.
But there was not enough for there to appear to be like intent to sell or anything like that. And toxicology screens came back that they were both, like, the adults, I mean the kids too, but the adults were both negative for all drugs,
right,
alcohol, anything. So it seemed kind of weird that there was weed in the house,
right,
but neither of them were positive for it. I suppose you can just have it in a jar and keep it and not be smoking it, but it did seem kind of weird that at least Keith didn't. I mean, I know Elaine was pregnant, so I was assuming if right. it would be anybody, maybe him.
Well, and even
but
with
that wasn't it.
I mean, that stays in your system for a long time.
Exactly.
So it means they were sober from it for
at least
a month. Weeks, right.
And it seemed just kind of weird because it was like out of place for them.
Right.
Like, that wasn't something that they'd ever talked about. But I mean, you know, do you have to talk openly about it to do it? I don't think so.
No.
Joanne, Keith's mom, believed that it belonged to the killer. In fact, Joanne had two theories.
Ooh, okay, Joanne.
One being that the killer tried to get her son to sell drugs and he refused.
Oh, that's sweet.
She thought the other possibility might be that a man had hit on Elaine, but Elaine turned him down and he was enraged about turning it down. And here's the thing, though, is because she's his mother.
Yep.
She's going to look at him in a way that others will not.
Correct.
And I have no doubt that Keith was an incredible man. By all reports, it appears that way. But maybe there's some hint from Joanne of, well, my son would never, or he wouldn't be involved in anything illegal like that.
Not mine.
Drugs are bad, not mine. And also, like, maybe trying to preserve his image as his mother to be like, no, don't conflate that. Don't confuse right. those things. This wasn't it. So I think it's all possible. I think what I rely on most for this indication is the toxicology results, which is that they were negative.
Right.
So it is possible that the marijuana actually wasn't theirs and was left behind either to throw off the scent, or maybe it just was and they just didn't smoke it.
Right.
Or
plenty of hadn't people. Yet. You and I'm going to say substances as a whole, but like including alcohol, use substances in a very healthy way. That's not overusing. That's not frequent use or habitual or daily.
Mm-hmm.
And so a month seems like a long time to have some kicking around still. But if it's me, allegedly, and I am hanging out smoking weed and then my wife gets pregnant with my first child, I might be stressed out because I don't know if that impacts them, and then maybe I don't touch it and now my kid's three and she's pregnant again and oh my god, I forgot I had that, like crazy that was part of our life back then, right? Like
it,
that's
yeah.
possible. Also, it's very sweet that his mom was thinking these things. The idea that you would ask someone to sell drugs for you and brutally murder them for saying no is a lot in my head. I think it's very sweet. I think she values him a lot. But I also worry anytime we deify the dead. I mean, and I don't want to vilify either. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But making someone out to be an angel puts them on a pedestal that's unfair to them for when they inevitably fall off of it, because nobody is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he can be an amazing person, but he still will never be perfect because that's part of being human.
Exactly. And I kind of agree where I think that it's kind of a stretch to be like, sell drugs for me. No. Okay. And then this happens because
right.
it just seems like you could have just shot them all.
Or just him. Why would you need to then go back to his family?
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there were, for lack of a better way of putting it, easier ways to do that had that been the end goal.
Right. If that was the concern. There's no need for the rest of it.
So we don't really know that it's their weed. We don't know that it isn't. I don't really think it's related, but I thought it was important to include.
Right.
These theories that Joanne had, I mean, she was devastated. Her son and her grandkids and her daughter-in-law were stolen from her in a single day just before the holidays. And she's left trying to put together the pieces because nobody had anything against them. So she's thinking, okay, did someone hit on Elaine? Like,
right.
on Elaine?
And
was it drugs? Was it, what was it?
I completely get it. I'd also be looking for absolutely any explanation I could think of. Because you feel so powerless. There's nothing else to do with that time.
Exactly. And these theories were considered by law enforcement and nothing really stuck. The
right.
community was less than 3,000 people.
Holy crap.
No one saw anything, or if they did, they didn't talk about it.
Right.
Speaking of the community, though, this rocked the area. They were just recovering from other recent homicides, and then a family of four is wiped out in a single day.
Mm-hmm.
And not just a family of four, but one that they knew. These were their sweet colleagues. Many knew little Peter and would see the family at church on Sundays. Many heard Keith lead the church choir. They were loved by their community, which made what happened to them even more unthinkable.
Right.
Firearm sales skyrocketed,
mm-hmm.
as did home security systems. They locked their doors, and they'd never done that before. They were looking over their shoulders constantly. People were paranoid. Oh. People were scared.
Well, of course, because if them, why not us?
Rural, small-town kindness gave way to paranoia and distrusting those around them. No, I don't trust my neighbor anymore. I don't trust the person next to me at church anymore, when before I would have given the shirt off my back for them.
Right.
If your car broke down, you might have asked a stranger for a ride or maybe knocked on doors in the neighborhood to use their phone, and now you wouldn't dare go up to someone's home uninvited.
Right.
And homeowners were sure as shit not going to let you in. Students in local schools waited inside the school for their parents to come pick them up. Like, especially wow. after sports games, they would hang outside and chat and kind of wait for their parents to get there and walk over. And now right. they stayed inside. The parents would park, go inside, get their kid and walk them to the car because they were afraid that from the walk from the school to the car, something could happen.
Right.
Like, it changed the whole dynamic where these people lived.
Oh.
Add to this the rumors. It's the 80s. What do you think they said?
Cocaine.
If you guess satanic panic, you win. I don't know what you win, but you win. When word got out that baby Casey was found there, rumor spread that it must have been a cult sacrifice and that the baby must have been cut from the womb.
Wow.
This wasn't true, but you hear that a child is there and the details aren't officially released. I mean, your fear is going to kind of run that narrative for you.
Yeah, it's filling in the gaps that nobody else did.
And we're talking about the 80s, and ultimately a newborn baby was killed. That kind of adds up. I can see how they got there. Also, the fact that Keith's genitals were mutilated seemed to reinforce this theory of, like, sacrifice and punishment and,
right.
I don't know. But, like, nearly all satanic panic theories, this one was disproven rather quickly.
Yeah.
But it still kind of hung on in the background for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Keith's friend Kevin said the Dardines were, quote, two of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet. They were such loving, caring people. It's hard to imagine how somebody can do something like this.
Wow. Well, and that probably added to it also, like, the engagement they had in their church, the family values that they had, and that, what's the opposite of that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Keith's sister Anita saw Peter after... Oh. the attack, after he was dead, and said that he looked like a very old person who had abused his life and body to the max.
Wow.
He did not look like a 3.5-year-old. She said whatever the killer did to that child that night stripped him of every feeling and emotion. Whatever innocence was in that 3.5-year-old was gone.
Oh my gosh.
The top prosecutor in the county, Gary Duncan, said of the crime, the brutality of the crime was just extreme, so terrible and egregious. It was a constellation of really awful acts.
Wow.
Leads dried up, though there weren't many to start with, and the case grew colder as new investigations took priority. But then there was a change. Years later, a new lead brought back hope that had seemed long lost.
Oh my gosh, so we're like years out now.
Years, years, years.
Okay.
A serial killer named Tommy Lynn Sells claimed that he had been the one who murdered the Dardine family.
Tommy.
So we're going to put a pin here and talk about Tommy Sells.
Okay.
And I'll warn you that his upbringing is horrific, and it does not excuse but might explain what he grew up to do.
Anytime we hear serial killer, I don't think unicorns shitting rainbows.
That's good.
As a kid, you know.
Yeah, that's good.
Thanks.
Hold on to that. Tommy and his twin sister were born in 1964 to unwed parents, never knowing for sure who his dad was, but the man he believed him to be died when Tommy was just a kid.
Wow.
He and his twin sister contracted meningitis as babies, and unfortunately, his sister didn't survive it. After this, he was passed from family member to family member and ended up with his aunt. His aunt cared for him from when he was like 2 to 7, I think. Okay. And this seemingly was like the best he'd ever had it. She was trying to pursue adopting him. But when his mom caught word of this, she fought to stop it and fought for him back and succeeded.
Wow.
So once his mother regained custody, she forbade Tommy from ever speaking with his aunt again, who was probably, arguably, the only person who ever showed him love.
Mm.
But under her care, and I'm using the term very loosely, Tommy began an alcohol addiction at the age of 7 years old.
Huh?
This is what his mother allowed. He was also groomed by older men.
Oh.
One of the men was sexually abusing him, and it's reported that his mom knew of this abuse and not only allowed it, but encouraged it. Was fine with it. He developed a drug addiction shortly after and displayed very concerning sexual behaviors.
Ugh. Oh my gosh. Okay.
One of which was trying to assault his own mother as she showered.
A sexual assault?
Yep.
Okay.
His addictions worsened and he didn't engage in any mental health treatment. Well, I don't think anything was offered to him. Well, this would have been the 70s. Yeah.
Oh, the 70s in rural Illinois. Yeah.
So this is what he had from like 2 to 7, loved, cared for.
And then it's ripped away.
And then the mom catches wind that this aunt actually like wants to keep him. And it was like, why did you fight to keep him when he needed saving from you?
And then you actively made it worse.
Light years worse. So fast forward to when Tommy is a teen, he had become transient. He traveled coast to coast across the U.S. by train hopping, hitching rides, or stealing cars. He'd work day labor jobs for cash that was instantly spent on drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, he committed several crimes and was incarcerated frequently. While incarcerated, he was diagnosed with a series of illnesses: antisocial personality disorder, substance use disorder, bipolar disorder, and psychosis, to name a few.
Wow.
But it didn't seem he was ever in one place long enough to get treatment. And nothing I've read about this man suggests he ever even tried. On New Year's Eve in 1999, in Del Rio, Texas, he broke into a home at night in which 2 young girls were sleeping. 13-year-old Kayleen Harris and 10-year-old Crystal Searles slept. He stabbed Kayleen. He slit her throat after sexually assaulting her. And then he slit Crystal's throat. Miraculously, 10-year-old Crystal survived. She ran a quarter mile to a neighbor's house for help, and she literally had to hold her neck together. And she did.
Oh my God.
Long enough to be able to tell law enforcement what happened, provide a sketch of her attacker, and ultimately the sketch that she gave led to his arrest.
Wow.
Crystal did survive her injuries, but sadly, her friend, 13-year-old Kayleen, did not.
Ugh.
Tommy Searles was convicted and sentenced to death in this murder. This sketch was actually very accurate, and it was very quickly linked to him.
Wow. That's hard to do with transient people at that time.
And the fact that he was sentenced to death means he wasn't getting out, but this was actually only the tip of the iceberg. Law enforcement linked him positively to 22 homicides.
Holy shit.
All over the country. Because he was transient, because he was kind of here, there, and everywhere, he committed crimes everywhere. It wasn't like he had so many in this area that he was easy to track down. As soon as he did it, he'd leave, and he was in another state by the time they noticed.
Right, and not for nothing, but when they're that brutal, how often do you get a survivor?
Absolutely. He didn't think that she survived that.
Well, clearly, yeah.
Like, he would have finished the job had he had any inkling that she was going to be able to go leave, basically. Right. But ultimately, 22 homicides were linked to him and confirmed to be him. He earned the nickname the Coast to Coast Killer.
Wow.
Once he was serving time, maybe he figured, what the hell, what do I have to lose? But he just started talking.
Yeah.
He claimed to kill more than 70 people. I mean, this guy was singing.
That's a lot.
So they said 22. He's like, no, north. 70. Yep.
Up a little. A little more.
Warmer.
Warmer. God, you guys, we're Luke fucking warm.
Like, warmer. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. This is the shit. So we can remove the pin from earlier.
Okay.
Because this is when he claimed that he had murdered Keith, Elaine, Peter, and Casey in November 1987.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, big butt. I like big butts, and I cannot lie, big butts.
With an itty-bitty waist and a round thing in my face?
His story was ever changing.
Sprung.
So what he said happened was different from the story he'd tell the next day.
Got
which would be different than the one he would tell next week, which made it increasingly difficult to find out, okay, did he really or did he not?
And is he just fucking with us or is this for real?
First, he claimed that he ran into Keith at a truck stop.
Okay.
And they struck up conversation and Keith invited him back to his home for a threesome.
Oh, that sounds not at all like Keith.
In another version, he met Keith at a pool hall.
Okay.
So not the truck station, now pool hall, but kind of same rules apply. Come back and hang out with me and my wife. In another version, he was invited to the family home for dinner.
Okay.
And then the threesome was brought up, which triggered Tommy and brought up memories of his own assault history. And he attacked the family then. First driving Keith to the field and killing him, and then returning to the house to do the rest. In my opinion, in his most likely version of events, he reports that he was in the area when he saw the for sale sign on the Dardian's trailer.
Mm.
So he was meandering around, sees that, and knew that that would be an excuse to gain access to the home and I'm to be interested. Able to talk to them. Yeah. Yes. So he went to the home and he spoke with Keith saying that he was interested in purchasing the trailer. Can I look around? Can we talk about finances?
Right.
And he was invited in because Keith wanted out of there. He of wanted course. To move. He wanted to sell this trailer. I don't know how many people he had that wanted it, but a lot of people didn't want to move there for the same reasons Keith was trying to get out.
Exactly.
So he had a prospective buyer. Yeah, come on in. Let's
let's talk
about it because my wife is due in literally 2 months.
Right.
And we'd like to be out of here by then.
And I'm due to be out of here by then.
From there, at gunpoint, he forced Keith to tie up his wife and son, and then he took Keith to the field where he mutilated him, telling him that he would take that home to Elaine.
Oh my God.
And then he killed him. Then he claims he raped and killed Elaine, and you know the rest. In 2010, Tommy sat for an interview with Becky Malkovich from the Southern Illinoisan.
Mm-hmm.
And the following quotes are actually from an article that she wrote about this interview, but I thought it was important to really hear a lot of, in his words, what happened and more about his life. Tommy didn't believe he was born evil, but he was just without help. He said, quote, "We'll never know because no one ever tried to help me. When your mother gives you to a pedophile, where's the help? And what in the right mind mother lets her 7-year-old boy sleep at a single man's house for years and thinks it's healthy?" Between 7 and 14 replays over and over in my mind. It don't quit. Meaning from the ages of 7 and 14, this is when she essentially condoned, if not encouraged, him to be elsewhere. He said, quote, "The pain don't stop. It's still there. I can't sleep a whole night without waking up with it.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is like a mirror and someone's taken a hammer to it. Seems like after 7, I just became numb. I became a dark soul. I think every time I've killed someone, I've killed that person," meaning the person who hurt him. Mm. So he's saying every time he kills a man, every time he kills anybody, in his mind, he's killing the person that abused him. When talking about the Dardian murder, he said, "They say there's no physical evidence tying me to the Dardians, but there wasn't for any of them because they weren't looking for me. I moved. I was always transient. If you want to believe different, I ain't going to argue the case. Texas will kill me first."
Mm.
And what he was saying there was that there wasn't physical evidence tying him to any of the murders that he committed, not just the Dardians, but they didn't know because they weren't looking for him.
Right.
And by the time that they might have considered him, maybe
he was already gone.
So it didn't matter.
Right.
And if you don't believe me, oh, well, Texas is going to kill me anyway. Like, I got the death penalty for the other one. So
don't worry about it.
Believe me or don't, I'm going to get mine. He said, "The details of his murders, all of his murders, are hazy."
Mm-hmm.
And truthfully, he can't remember them because he was on a lot of drugs. He was living a very hard life. And he's talking about these cases 10, 20, 25 years after they happened.
And also, you know, you hear of like red outs. If this is trauma triggered mental health based, it's very normal to me that he would have some sort of a readout and not like have all of those pieces to put together, even if he wasn't on significant drugs and transient.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those together, how the hell are we going to expect him to say the shirt was yellow? You know what I mean? Like,
right. And he also said this. He said, I don't even remember half the murders I'd done. I think one of the things that helped me to survive all my life with all the sexual molestation and beatings, when something happens, I stop thinking about it. It's over. That's like with a lot of my crimes. Once it's over, I stop believing I was part of it. Because they say I've done pretty gross stuff, and some of it I can say, yeah, I remember some of that. But some of it I'm not so sure. There's been so many. How do you tell one from another? So he's essentially saying that throughout his abuse as a kid, he was able to dissociate and remove himself from it, and that he can cope with it because he just stops believing he was part of what happened, and he's able to turn that part off because he was forced to survive when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then never got like any treatment or any kind of help or searched for it or did anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead just inflicted those horrific things onto other people. And tenfold. Then it's very easy for him to flick the switch and be done with it.
Right.
Attorney Greg Duncan would have brought up charges against Tommy Sells, but despite his confession, there was like nothing to go on.
Yeah.
He claims he did it. He says, yeah, I went there, but he also said he met him at the truck stop. And he also said he met him at the pool hall. And he also said that he was invited for a threesome, which is not at all.
My pregnant wife, who isn't here, and I, who are staunch Christians, really dug your vibe. Do you want to come over?
Man, we've just met. Yeah.
As if. He's so fucking for real.
Did he just forget the details? Did he make it up? Did he have nothing at all to do with this? Or a little bit? Did he have help? Right. There's a lot of questions. Some of the details of the case, he got spot on. But so did the media, right, which is where he might have heard it first. When quizzed on other details that weren't released, he was wrong a few times before he'd sometimes get the right answer, which some believed he could have just guessed until he got it right.
Right.
But there were some things he knew that maybe he couldn't have known.
Okay.
But also, could he have guessed? I mean, how many different variations? It was pretty laid out in the media.
Right. And also, you know,
and we're relying on his memory, where he's admittedly been like, I've been high, drunk, and living a hard life my entire life. And you're asking me about something that happened 20 years ago. And
dissociated ever since, right. 10,
15, 20 years ago, you're asking me to recall this. This isn't, what kinds of details do you think you're going to uncover here?
Right.
Tommy was incarcerated for that murder in Texas already. And even though he claimed if he could go back to Illinois, he would walk the investigators through the crime scene and prove that he was the killer.
Okay.
He could tell them where he was, where he took Keith, what he did. But Texas law was very strict that death row inmates couldn't leave the state.
Mm.
So they wouldn't let him go do that.
Right.
And you'd really fight for it, but you'd also have to believe him. And how truthful was he really?
Right.
So they weren't able to bring him to Illinois to have him prove it. So that just kind of ended there. Tommy knew Joanne Dardeen wanted to speak with him.
Mm-hmm.
So Tommy knew that Keith's mom was like, did you kill my son?
Yeah.
Did you kill my whole young fucking man, family?
What the fuck did you do? Yeah.
And he said this. Joanne wants to talk to me. If she wants to come here and talk to me, scream at me, yell, kick me, hit me, she should have that right. But sorry ain't gonna cut it. So what is there to say? I could tell her sorry every day for the rest of my life. It's not gonna stop her pain. And one thing I do know about is pain, and it don't go away. I don't know if I understand forgiveness. I don't think so. They never did meet. Tommy was put to death in April of 2014 for his...
Wow.
For the murder of the 13-year-old. The Dardeen murder is still technically unsolved. Sells was never charged with their murders, but many of the investigators believe justice was served for the Dardeen case when Tommy Sells was put to death.
Okay.
That even though they couldn't prove it in a court of law, Sells got what he deserved for what he did to them. They believed he knew too much and certainly had the history to prove that he was capable of the most unimaginable crimes. However, it depends who you ask. theories are polarizing. Because Tommy's story gets torn apart too. For example, everyone who knew Keith said there was no way in hell he would have invited Tommy Sells over his home for dinner when he especially didn't let a young woman in to use his phone when her car broke down.
Right.
Because he was so paranoid about the increase of crime in the area and he wouldn't have let a young man, a 22-year-old man, who he didn't know inside with his wife and kid.
Right.
He also wouldn't have suggested a threesome. That was something that they would have not done. And many believed Tommy made that up so that he'd have an excuse to claim self-defense. So saying, well, yeah, he had me in.
This is triggering.
Yeah, yeah. But they tried to force me or tried to pressure me into a threesome with them. So ultimately, I needed to defend myself.
Right.
That's what he was saying. And they're like, okay, well, we don't buy that.
Yeah.
More than that, many investigators thought that he was playing the system. The same idea came about with Henry Lee Lucas, in that they believed Tommy was admitting to murders he didn't commit because the system might show leniency for his help in solving those cases. He couldn't get out, but maybe he could have better arrangements made. Maybe there was an incentive to keep him alive to close other cold cases.
Right.
And hey, maybe don't put him to death right away because he's still of use to us. There's still value. He's still
talking. Yeah.
So they thought that maybe he was just sort of talking for the sake of talking because he might be spared the death penalty.
Yeah.
And ultimately they figured that maybe if he had told about every murder he committed, that even if he didn't have anything left to say, he could have made an arrangement early on to say, spare me the death penalty and I'll tell you everything I know.
Right.
So that even if the information, like he was done pouring it out, he'd still be good for the rest of his life. Like, this didn't need to be this ongoing arrangement that he would just have made a deal initially.
Right.
So they were kind of suspicious that, okay, if a killer has something to gain from talking, how much stock can you put in what they're saying?
Right. Especially when there's no other evidence linking what they're saying to the facts of the case or historically correct information.
Right. And if you want to read more about Tommy Sells, I'd suggest the book that I mentioned earlier by Diane Fanning. It's called Through the Window. And then it's like the story of Tommy Lee Sells, serial, whatever. It's like a very long title. But if you want to read that, I'd recommend it. Didn't want to include that earlier on.
Okay.
So my question is, did Tommy Sells happen upon the Dardenne trailer and inflict hell on earth? Was he invited over for a threesome? Did he claim credit for some sick ego play or even a chance at judicial leniency? Did he have an accomplice if he was involved at all? Was he even in Illinois at the time of the murders? Can we trust his storytelling? Based on his substance use, decades past, and reckless behavior, can we trust that he is an accurate historian? Was he responsible? And if he wasn't, their killer could still be out there.
Right.
So while many investigators are hanging their hat on the fact that, hey, we didn't get him in writing on it, but he got his. And we can rest assured that, you know, we don't need to chase ghosts anymore, that it's been done.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the possibility that you didn't get him. And he had his own theory on how he might be able to benefit from telling you that he did.
Right.
And this case was covered.
Yeah.
Because of how horrible it was. But yeah, some of the details didn't make it out.
Right.
But he's also like, well, some of the details I'm hazy on because I was drunk, high, and fucking 20 years younger.
And if he's claiming his victim count is upwards of 50, then yeah, literally, how do you tell one from the other?
Like, I couldn't.
He did that all the time.
I personally think Tommy Sells is responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And my takeaway, one of the many lessons I think that we can learn from this case, actually lies with Tommy. He wasn't protected as a child. He was abused from the start, and he was failed.
Mm-hmm.
Failed by the adults that were supposed to protect him. Failed by school systems who should have noticed his absence. Failed by the legal and victim-centered systems we have in place to protect children from monsters. And in turn, he himself became a monster. He coped with his pain by inflicting pain. He could simply turn it off. And his victims were failed by shit police work, where he was caught and released, spending minimal time in prison. Mm. I'm not a lock 'em all up kind of gal, but good God, when someone shows you time and time again that they will continuously commit violent crime, why don't we believe them?
Yep.
So I want to hear it from you, dear listener. Did he do it? What theories do you have? Do you know something? If so, report it.
Yeah.
What are your takeaways? What's something that we can hold on to from this tragedy that helps us keep ourselves and each other safe?
Because I'm on the same page. I think it was him. But this brings up a lot for me. Because if it's in my brain, the most realistic is house is up for sale. I want to get the fuck out of here. Come take a look.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes advantage of that. But the things that really sell it to me as an issue is he is a man who has clearly significant trauma, significant mm-hmm. sexual trauma, specifically from a man. We see some rage in his murder of Keith and sort of the dismemberment there, mm-hmm. the shooting of like the I'm getting rid of this guy immediately. And to me, that speaks to his delusion, I guess, that anytime he was killing someone, he was killing his assailant.
Yeah, he essentially removed the weapon
yes.
that was used against him.
And then it was a fast, immediate get out of here. Like, you will be doing no more harm. Mm-hmm. And to me, that says, okay, traumatic rage, sort of like, I will pacify you as fast as possible. And then clearly there's some anger with mom, which like there fucking should be. But then he goes back to this home and there's a loving mother with her son who's in the ages that he was when he had love. And in his brain, he's probably like, I'm helping this kid because everything turned to shit for me after that.
Yeah, I mean, it could be.
And I'm pissed at mom because she's representative of all the things that I hate, not of the things that hurt me, but the things that allowed those traumas to happen, well, essentially.
And I should also mention that the theory is they believe that Peter was killed before mm-hmm. in front of Elaine.
Well, and this is also...
So she had to watch her child die, but also that, like... This is what happens when mothers don't,
right?
You know, like his twisted version of things. It's like, my mother let this happen to me. I'm going to make her watch this happen to hers.
Right. Or also like, I'm going to try. And if you can't stop me, then you don't deserve X, Y, Z. Like, and that's another like flawed logic that we see a lot.
And you add in thing. You add in all of this criminal thinking, you mental illness, you add in substance use.
Zero stability.
And of course you're gonna have like we shouldn't be able to make perfect sense of this,
right? And I believe that he was responsible, especially if he's bringing it up. It wasn't super covered, like it was because it was a big deal, but then it was like, oh, this is really shitty, we can't, like, we gotta downplay this or play it less than we would otherwise, like, right. And so for him to then say, I remember the name of the family, the people involved, what happened, even though I might not remember the exact chronological timeline or, you know, whatever. I do think it's typical from what I've seen, and that's limited, but from what I've seen with people who have like a variety of diagnoses that are like that, to sort of have those memory lapses and then create a story that makes sense in your head of why you might have done that thing, even if that's not the truth.
Yeah, and not only that, but I guess so
like the threesome story to me, right? If it's a rage, like a red out, and he doesn't remember that in his head, like what would get me to do that? And then that's what he's reporting as the story.
Well, they're also saying though that in a lot of his retelling of things, that it wasn't uncommon for him to put blame on the victim, to be like, well, they did that, like mm-hmm. to make the victim seem like an unsavory person.
Right.
By being like, oh, well, you know, he was into this.
Well,
he
lessens his guilt.
Yeah. And right. So it's like, and I was defending myself, and also look at what a piece of shit he is for trying to force this on me. And so, of course, I had to do this. So he would kind of use like these little things about his victims that weren't mm-hmm. that. Often, most likely, were not true.
Right.
But that it seemed to semi-justify what it was that he was doing, even though I don't think that that could have been further from the truth. I think that it was,
right.
Hey, we wanted to get the hell out of here because shit was getting rough and you want to buy this place?
Right.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, and also too, like, I think of them and I think of the kind of people that they've been made out to be. And if it was me in a family like that, someone might come up looking gruff saying they want to buy my trailer. And I say, okay, yeah, let's look at that. And they're like, okay, I've had a really rough go of it and I can finally afford something. Like, I'd love to get stable. I'd love to get on the ground. And then maybe Elaine is sitting there like, oh, like maybe you should come over for dinner. You know what I mean? Like, I can see how good people put faith in others when there's enough time that you feel like the urgency of the threat has passed, of like, okay, if he hasn't hurt us by now, he won't hurt us. So like, come over for dinner kind of thing.
Right. And isn't it sort of ironic that their attempt to get out to be safer is what, like, having that for sale sign, trying right. to sell it, like that was their, like, boots on the ground attempt to make change, to move, right. to get out of there. And this could have been what attracted their killer to them, is so
right.
ironic. Awful. And horrible that their attempt to be safe got could have put them in line with, like, one of the most sadistic killers ever. Right. And if you want us to cover Tommy Lynn Sells, like, let
we'll do it. Let us
let us know. But there, it is so gruesome. The things he is so horrid.
Well, and the things that I think about too with this case, like, I quite literally cannot sit and think about Casey. I can't think of your entire life being that. That is beyond.
Nope. That's, I had to move right on because I'm not crying again. So we're going to keep going.
Nope. And I have done a very good job.
You kept it in.
Of swallowing that down a couple times.
I saw you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you can perceive me.
Yes.
but the thing that really makes me angry about this is his capability to reflect later on, if this is true. And so I guess my anger for this case comes in a few parts. The first is, like, we've talked about some really horrid shit here. Like, we have. Between mm-hmm. this, we had the Mount Vernon home invasion. That was awful. There was a bowling alley massacre. And I think about, and we talked about the Hello Kitty murders, and like these cases that are so big, so heavy, so awful that they just sit in your stomach no matter where you are, no matter what's going on. Like, you just sit with them. They need to be talked about the most, in my opinion. Not the most because they're more valuable as victims, or the story itself is more valuable or sellable. In fact, it's almost the opposite. It's because they are just as valuable as victims as everybody else, and they had to go through insurmountable, almost unspeakable things. And then because of that, it doesn't get talked about. That's so frustrating.
Well, and the funny thing was Joanne had tried to get this case on, like, cable news networks.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it was like 2020, but it was probably like America's Most Wanted, like, so, like,
right, like a 48-hour, something, yeah, like big the, like that.
But
yeah.
like the earlier ones where it was like, right. can you get this out? Like, we need answers. We need something. And they were like, we will not talk about that on the air.
Yeah, we and won't so do that.
It was this awful situation for her. So she's like, so what happened to my family was too tragic
right.
for you to try to help solve. Like, it was so bad. The details are so horrific and just vile
that we won't even speak of it,
that we just simply will ignore it and talk about something that is still bad but easier to talk about than how bad this was.
Right. And so that is increasingly frustrating as we talk about more of them. But also then it brings up for me this whole, he can sit here and he can say, I know pain.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sit there and you can blame everybody else for not getting help, but you can't put on your big boy panties and walk yourself over to, like, the fucking community mental health spot or your doctor or the police station and say, hey, I'm fucking worried. I need help. You don't even have to fucking admit to anything. You can just say, I'm having a rough go. What do you got?
Like, well, right. And so when he sat for this interview with Becky, this was in 2010, and he was put to death in 2014. So he had from 1999, probably early 2000s, when all the court stuff was done for the New Year's Eve 99 murder. He'd had about a good solid decade of, like, incarceration to
right.
probably the first time he'd ever been sober. I mean, not that you can't get drugs in prison, but I find it likely they kept an eye on him. This was the longest he'd ever been in one spot.
Yeah, this with was a bed and healthcare and food.
Probably the first time that he'd had, like, mental health treatment. So I can understand why he'd have a more clear perspective and be able to articulate more of it in that time. But I think he's also like, yeah, every time I did this, I pictured this. Like, he's kind right. of looking at it more profoundly, probably because he's had access to care. That, I mean, ultimately, he most likely had access to it several times.
Exactly.
But he never wanted it. He never did anything about it until it was far too late.
And he had no other option. And that's the
now
thing.
Now it's forced on him. And so now he's doing it. And now he can look on it and say, okay, yeah, this is probably why I did that. When I had a mother who essentially pimped me out, that's what he's mm-hmm. saying. Like, he's like, she allowed it. Who knows? She could have been making money. Like,
oh, yeah. If she you're was encouraging horrible. It. That to me says there's gain for you somewhere. And whether that's just mental health related or it's externally, I don't care.
But like, he wasn't protected. Like, he was hurt
right.
his entire childhood. Nobody protected him. Nobody loved him. Nobody was there for him in that way, which is horrible for the child. But then he grew up and he was just like,
fuck it.
Well,
he
just inflicted that pain onto other people because all he knew was pain. And he's like, yeah, well, I can pretend I'm killing the person who did this to me. So,
and I can understand, like, mental health is not logical. Mental health is not grounded or rooted in reality. And I understand that. But to me, if you can get to a point, even if the articulation and the clarity is what he gained once he got sober and stable, or sober and stable enough. Mm-hmm. The fact that he's saying the year 7 to 14 played through my mind constantly says that he was aware that before 7, it wasn't like that.
Yeah, that because that's when his aunt had him.
Someone. Mm-hmm. So maybe mom forbade you from talking to her, but that didn't stop you from leaving at 14, being transient and murdering people. You could have just fucking gone to your aunt's. Mm-hmm. You could have gone to it. Like, there are so many ways he could have, even in all of that pain, taken that and made it not somebody else's fucking trauma, let alone 22 confirmed, maybe up to 70 people's, mm-hmm. which, of course, we always know in cases like this, your victim is not the only victim.
Nope.
Your victim is the first of many waves of victims that are impacted by this shit. So, like, I think there's anger in me that there's enough clarity to understand where things went wrong and that things were okay at one point, and it's that transfer of okay to bad that made you kind of like your mental health maybe trigger or start. But then you still know that, and then you get here and it's like, great, yay for talking about it. I appreciate that in this sense he is doing what he can, so I'll give him that. But this is the other infuriating part of this for me, and I find it with a lot of these really rough ones and these, like, we're pretty sure we got them cases, mm-hmm. right, where you can say with like a 10-15% maybe room for error, but like a pretty high confidence interval that, like, yeah, we're pretty sure we're on the money with this one, that this is the problem with criminal justice as an entity, because it's never victim justice. It's never justice for the people who lost the things they lost. It's, can we say we got him?
Yeah, well, can we bring the criminal to justice? Can we bring them?
Right.
Can we find them and effectively and legally prove it?
Well, and I think that that's important. I think there are so many, like, limits and boundaries that are important to talk about with that. Like, no, we can't break the law for someone who broke the law to bring them to justice. Mm-hmm. That is a lot for me. It's the same reason there's a lot of arguments against the death penalty. Like, can you ethically do the same thing you're putting someone to death for doing? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But when we talk about things like this, all I can think about is their fucking family. I think of his mom. I think of Joanne. And everything she did, I'm sure the hairs that grayed, the mm-hmm. wrinkles that formed, the sleepless nights, the new hypervigilance, hyperfixations, the metaphorical dirt under her fingernails has to be so fucking thick. And yet, what we get is, you can talk to him if you want.
Yeah, and she was so, like, I didn't include many quotes from her, mostly because I thought we'd all cry, but she was like, I'll know if I see him. Like, she's like, I need to talk to him. Like, she really thought that she could
feel just it,
kind of like find out and know. But I mean, he already said everything he had to say. I think,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe there's something to be said for, like, if she had an hour in a room with the same baseball bat and no cameras. I don't know. I know that we have to be better than that and we're civilized and whatever. But there is, like, a shred of me that's, like, based on just fucking, like, premise.
Right.
You get it.
It's the principle of it. Like,
just based on principle, she should get some, just close the door, just go for a walk, go out to lunch, mm-hmm. and come back, and oh my god, what happened?
It happened for Jeffrey. I mean, allegedly.
Like, you know what I mean? But, like, there are, I can understand that. I don't know what closure she would have gotten from that, because
right.
it's not like he was like, ah, yes, this is the reason. Or by saying, well, they tried to have a threesome with me, you know that that isn't true. So you're not going to get the truth here. You're going to get right. whatever version of it that he feels comfortable sharing, if he remembers it at all. Willing
to.
Yeah. And that he knows who he's talking to, you know. But I think that, like, in so many, like, true crime podcasts especially, people kind of choose one or the other, where it's like all of the blame lies with him and he had those actions and he was terrible. Okay, mm-hmm. absolutely fair. And then the other flip side is, it's not, he's a product of his environment. He's not responsible for it. It's all these other systems that failed him. And I disagree there, because it's really both.
It's always both.
Like, you have to look at both. And I think some people are very, like, I think some people have tunnel vision, where it's like, it's one or the other, and you're kind of looking for evidence yeah. of that. But it really is both. He was failed.
Absolutely. But
he also has free will, and he made decisions that were horrible, that caused pain, that killed other people. And he is responsible for that, whether he did or didn't get services he should have had.
Right. And I think it's so fair. You know, you feel for the kid.
Oh, yeah.
That kid had no fucking chance. But the thing is, he also had choice.
Exactly.
You can have everything set up to fail, and damn it, you're going to fail. But that's why, when we talk about sociology, when we talk about psychology, when we talk about culture as a whole, we have these safety nets. It's why your kids go to school every day. It's why there's a community center. It's why there's clubs. It's why people put time and effort and money, most of all, into things that are for enjoyment or for pleasure or for communal reasons that are beyond, like, the food, water, sex, sleep, shelter that you need to survive as a species.
Mm-hmm.
And when those systems don't work, that's the other reason there are so many. There are churches, there are schools, there are communities, there are all of these nets, in the hopes that when one fails you, because inevitably one will have to, you can't be everything for everyone all the time. So when something fails you, you have a chance at not slipping through the next one. But when all of them fail you, you still have a rock bottom to hit. And it's up to you what you do with that. You can sit there and say, damn it, it's everybody's fault, I'm down here. And that's true. But it's not their fault. You're not trying to climb out.
Mm-hmm.
And by not doing that, you're dragging other people down with you. Because if you can, if you are that person, if your family has caused such heinous trauma, such shit that you've been through, you've experienced some of the worst. And in my opinion, I do think that having a period of stable, loving home then ripped away from you is potentially worse than never having it at all. Especially when you go from that to what he went through. Nobody hears that story, and nobody sees the holes in the fucking net if you don't point them out.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause the whole point is, you were missed. They didn't let you go. They didn't see you and say, bye, have fun down there.
Right.
And so it's just, I think it's frustrating to me that there is still no clear path to what we can do for the victims that survive things like this. Whether you're the 10-year-old Crystal, I think it was, who survived his attack that got him on death row, or whether you're him that survived these things. Like, there is so little that we can clearly, confidently, and ethically say we can do for victims, specifically for victims, just because you were wronged this way. And I also think it's so frustrating when we let that be the entirety of it. Because the government is great in so many ways, but the government is flawed and limited in so many ways too, that if we put all of our rest there, we potentially miss a greater picture. And if we don't put any confidence there, then we lean towards another area of problematic vigilantism, kind of. And so it's this never-ending balance that never quite has reached equilibrium, I guess. And it's so devastating because this was a family that was doing things for their community. They were those safety nets for people.
They just happened to have a for sale sign because they happened to be trying to make for a better life, the pursuit of a better life. Which
that's their right.
You can't fault for that.
No, and in fact, if anybody could understand that, I would hope it would be him.
Maybe he was envious of that.
Probably.
Not that he would have known that, but he probably would have done it anyway.
This is a rough one.
So I want to hear from you guys. Do you think he did it? Do you think it's possible we're missing something? Do you think he had help? That was something that Joanne never felt like she got clarity on, was, you know, she could be like, I believe that he really could have done it. Also believe that it could have been difficult for him to do alone. So did he have an accomplice?
I think those are great questions. I would love to hear what you guys think. I think it is most likely that he did it alone, but I do think it would have been a very manic, very frenzied hour for him, and that would have been potentially hard to miss.
Yeah, and then he stuck around, and then he laid all the bodies in bed, like tucked in them, in bed, posed them, cleaned up a little bit, and like laid them all out on the couple's bed. Like, that is just so fucking odd.
Right.
So I have a lot of thoughts, but I do want to hear from you guys. So definitely let us know. You can let us know on Instagram. You can let us know down below in the, like, what did you think about this episode part. Yes. If you're listening on Spotify, you can let us know via email. You can let us know, are there other cases that are, you know, very difficult that we don't hear enough about for this reason? Are they ones that you want covered? Do you want a Tommy Lynn Sells series? Because 22 confirmed, there's a whole hell of a lot to talk about.
There's a lot there.
So we need to hear from you in order to do that.
Yes, let us know. You can find all of those outlets, ways to contact us, all of that down below in our link tree that's linked always. That will have our Instagram so you can see the people, the places, the things we post for every episode. If you are starting here, wow, I double up on the sorry, but you would be able to see anything that we're talking about that there's photographic evidence of that we can get up there. You can also see on our Instagram. You can kill some time on our Instagram. You do a phenomenal job with it.
Thank you.
I don't do it. Allie is far better at that kind of stuff. I'm more of the technical nerd on the audio side, but like,
I have a lot of fun.
There's so many reprieves. So like little memes, silly, goofy, wholesome things to make you feel better about all of this shit. There's pod pets. There's resources if you're trying to feel better and you can't stop thinking about it like me.
We got all that on there for you, baby.
It's all there. Seriously, spend some time. It's a very rich environment to be. But you could also email us. That's linked down below. You could follow us. There's Redbubble if you wanted to support in the form of buying merch or stickers or something like that. Christmas is coming up. We might do a Christmas sticker or mug.
We are also really very much considering merch and dipping our toe into that. But like, we want to know what you guys would like. We're not going to make something that you guys are like, ew.
Ew. Yeah, we have a few prototypes and people have gotten like the very early end of that. But we would love to dive in soon. So send us any of your ideas, your thoughts. If there's something that you're like, I am dying to get a freaking cup or an ornament or something, like, just let us know and then we make it happen. But for what we have already, that's on Redbubble. Check it out there. Or you could donate in a more direct way, whether that is Venmo or PayPal, which is also linked. But you have plenty of time to investigate that, because we won't be here with a new case for you for another week. So definitely dive in a little bit. But if I do look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye. I'm sorry.
What the hell?
I'm sorry.
It's bad.
I know it hurts.